Welcome back. It's the last session of the day, but you guys are just getting started, right? You got two more days of cramming all this information into your brains. All right, we're going to finish out with a nice light session on Windows Communication Foundation. So we're going to take a look at some of the new features in WCF around simplified configuration. If I've heard anything from people doing Windows Communication Foundation, it's frustration at the configuration story, so we'll see how that gets simplified. REST is all the rage. We talked about WCF data services and all the improvements in ASP.NET with routing and things, so we'll take a look at some of the improvements in the programming model here for building REST-based services. Discovery of services. We'll look at workflow services, a different way to implement your service logic and expose that out to enable long-running workflow processes with message correlation. And we'll finish up by looking at the routing service, which gives you some flexibility and enables a lot of different scenarios, including versioning, data partitioning, and other things that make it really useful. So on the simplified configuration, all right, Microsoft heard loud and clear from people using WCF. A lot of what they heard was, why isn't this as easy as ASMX? All right, when I just did file new web service and it worked. Well, part of the reason is that it's more complex because it supports more things, right? With WCF, I can do named pipes and NetTCP and all sorts of other connectivity for my service, so it's not just about an HTTP-based web service. But part of the reason is just because they didn't make it that way, right? And so they said, well, all right, how can we make it easier for people to get up and just say, I want a new service, and I don't want to have to configure a lot of things. So one of the things they did is they set up protocol mappings, where essentially if you have a service and you're listening on a particular address, HTTP colon something, they're going to look at the scheme and see HTTP, and they're going to make some decisions. They'll say, all right, well, we're going to pick for you a default binding. All right, if you use an HTTP, then we're going to pick the basic HTTP binding, right? If you're using NetTCP, we're going to pick for you the NetTCP binding. We'll look at that scheme and decide for you which binding to use by default, so you won't have to configure it. We also have the ability, instead of having one of the things in the config files with WCF, is you go out and say, here's my service, and then you have to hook everything together. You have to say, oh, well, I've got this behavior down here where I configure things like metadata and authorization, and I've always got to make sure that I tie those things together by name. And if I'm hosting several different services, I got to make sure they all tie down there. So we have this notion of unnamed behaviors now, where if you put a behavior in and you don't provide a name, it'll just get applied to all the services that are that config file applies to. Right? We have the same thing with binding configurations. So if I say, you know what, I've got a configuration for the HTTP binding, or I'm tweaking things like security or the encoding, and I don't want to have to go for every endpoint and point to that. I just don't give it a name, and it will be applied to any endpoint using that binding. The other thing they did is they added this notion of standard endpoints. So when you're going in and adding things like a metadata exchange endpoint, there are certain things that are fixed. In that example, the contract is always the same. It's always iMetadata Exchange. So why not just make it easier for you to say, you know what, I want to add a metadata exchange endpoint. Great, you don't need to tell us the contract, right, or the binding. We'll just figure that out. And you can just provide the address, if you want, for where that sits. So we have these standard endpoints that some of them are around discovery, which we'll talk about. We have the metadata exchange. We have endpoints for workflow control. So there are a set of endpoints, kind of a new kind of endpoint, that you can register in the config system and say, look, if I say I'm creating this kind of endpoint, you already know some of the information, right? Something is assumed. And the last one is configuration-activated services, right? And this basically is, hey, look, I'm going to, in my config file, say that requests to a particular endpoint are mapped onto a given service. And that means I don't have to have a physical SVC file out there in my web directory if that's where I'm hosting it. I just want to go in the configuration and say, look, if somebody tries to go to myservice.svc, then here's the service type and here's the service host factory you should use. So rather than having to create a bunch of files, I can manage all that stuff through the configuration. So if we go out here, I've got a new project. Let's just go out and do a new project. And under WCF, we'll create a WCF service application. Call it what's new in WCF. So that's going to create me a web project. It's going to give me my SVC file and my interface. If we go look at the config, though, we'll see a couple of things. One is, if I collapse the behaviors, there's no endpoint. There's no service. There's no configuration in here, really, that's specific to my service. And yet, if I go out and right-click and say View in Browser, it just works, right? I've got the service out there. I could set up the service client, and I could call this. And so there's a couple things going on here. One is this unnamed behavior. I said if you have a behavior in your config and it doesn't have a name, it applies to all the services within this, or that this config applies to, right? So any service here is going to get the metadata support, which we saw was turned on, and it has the service debug as well. All right, so automatically my service picked up that particular behavior, and I got the documentation page and the WSDL. It also got some defaults in terms of the binding. Right? Let me run this here. And we'll run the test client. Are you all aware of the WCF test client? This is my this is a tool that let me get to the actual file. This is a tool that shipped in earlier versions that allows you to just go out and test these things. So you don't have to go build your sample application. So you can see if we look at the config file for the client, right, it definitely generated an endpoint and it chose the basic HTTP binding. The address, it assumed to be that of our SVC file. And the contract, of course, it picked up from that. So automatically, we're in a web project, so obviously we're using HTTP. From that, it's picked up, all right, I'm going to choose a default binding for you, and I'm going to configure that. Oops. So if I go out here, let me stop that, and we'll go out and load up to the Microsoft.net, framework v4, config, machine.config. And if we go down and look in here, we'll see in the service model section, we're going to find a number of different things. We've got our extensions. Got the common behaviors. Right? And if we look, you can see this is what I mentioned around those endpoints. So you'll see, right, announcement endpoints, workflow control, web HTTP. So these are kind of our default endpoints that I mentioned. So some of these are automatically configured here in the config. Let me search through rather than manually finding this. And that one's in the default, I think. So we've got the protocol mappings, which is going to give us, when it finds it, is going to give us those mappings between the scheme and the protocols that we've got there. I clearly should have opened that up before. There we go. It's in the defaults with the comments. So we've got the protocol mappings in here. We can see for a particular protocol or scheme, it's got the binding set. And so if you decide on your machine or in your environment that, hey, if you use an HTTP, I still want configuration to be simple. I still want you to be able to use that simple model and just have things up and running, but I want you to use the WSHTTP binding. And maybe I want to apply a specific configuration. Right here, again, it's just use the default. I might point that to a particular binding configuration. And so what that means is across the machine, if you simply accept whatever the binding is that's automatically chosen, you'll get what's in the machine config. So we've got our service out here, all right, it's up and running with no config. The other thing I mentioned is you can, move this guy up. I'm going to delete that. It doesn't want to let me kill that one, and then I'll add back in that class. So I still have the service class out there, but I don't really want to have the SVC file. I can come into the web config. And in the service hosting environment, you can see I've got service activations. So I can add, and here I've got the service. All right, that's going to be my service type. Service one. If I had a namespace, yeah, so we got what's new. So I've got the service type, the relative address. So I'm going to change that to myservice.svc, so it's different. And then I don't need a specific factory, so I'm going to leave that blank. So now if I come out and I go to myservice.svc, right, which isn't a physical file, there is no SVC file, I still get the behavior applied, it knows which service it's going after, it allows me to still use that service as if there was a physical file there. Right. So some of these are small things, but for people that have struggled with the configuration in WCF, people are pretty happy about these. So default mappings, default application of bindings and behaviors, simply by not providing a name on them. And then the service activation allows me to just come into the config and say, here's the address that people are going to use for the endpoint. Here's the service and optionally the service host factory that maps onto. All right. Now, before I forget, I'm going to come in here and turn on ASP.NET compatibility because I'm going to need it in the next one. And I'm going to turn it on in this service, too. So I'm just turning this on. This is going to allow me to support ASP.NET compatibility in WCF. So that should all still build and compile. All right. Questions about the config before I move to the next? All right, REST programming improvements. So the REST model, right, is WCF allows us to do SOAP-based services. It really, as the communication framework, replaces or sits on top of a lot of the existing technology. So I can do .NET remoting style apps with it, right, where it's all internal and I do TCP. I can do SOAP-based services. And then in the last releases, there's been this focus on improving the support to do these REST-based services. I'm doing HTTP gets and posts. And on the back end, that maps onto my service class where I've got operations that then are going to fulfill those requests. So a couple of things that they added in. One is support for the ASP.NET caching. If you have a lot of people coming to your service and doing gets of data, you want to be able to support passing that back out and doing caching so that you optimize the scalability of your service and so you don't hit the database every time. And so they've simply hooked in and allow you to put attributes on your service, point to an ASP.NET cache profile, and then they apply the caching to the results right there as you automatically as you send those results back. So as new requests come in, they'll look at the cache, look at the profile, and see if they should serve it from the cache if it's there. A big thing for these REST-based services where HTTP GET is such a big deal. The other is you've got a lot more control in terms of the error reporting or the fault handling. You know, in the past, basically people just got one or two status codes from HTTP. And if you're a user, it's mostly just frustrating because you really don't know what's wrong. But if you're programming against these services now, you really need the ability to find out, well, what is it that went wrong, right? Is it an authorization failure? Does the item not exist? And so you have a lot more control now by using this web fault of T, or this web fault exception, where you can indicate a particular status code. You can even provide a template or markup that goes back to the client. So if it is, you know, something where a user is interacting, you can send back something readable. If it's a computer-based, right, or a system calling you, then the markup might just be extra XML that that system wants to look at and parse through. So you have a lot more control by throwing these type of exceptions in terms of what the client sees as the error. All right, and more importantly, it's more consistent with the HTTP protocol and sending back the right status for that that protocol. The other big thing people have been asking for is, you know, with a SOAP-based web service, I go in and I can browse to the metadata as you just saw. And when I do that, I get a nice documentation page. It gives me information about how to build a proxy, gives me a link over to the web service description language. But with REST-based services, right, we really don't have all that metadata in terms of a WSDL. There is no kind of formalized and kind of fully accepted model. There is the web application description language that people are working on. But a lot of times when people do REST-based services, what they really rely on is, hey, just tell me what the different URIs are that I can use and show me what the messages should look like. What is my request supposed to look like? What is my response going to look like coming back? So they have an automatic documentation page now, just like they do for SOAP services, where you say, hey, look, I'm going to build this REST service, and I want to enable documentation. They'll show you the different operations and the URIs. They'll give you example messages. They'll also allow you to pull the schemas. Right, so they look at your types, and they generate schemas on the fly, just like they do for SOAP services, and allow people to pull them down into their client, or if they want, they can build proxies or code right to the XML. You also have the ability to customize what that looks like simply by applying some attributes to your services. You can go in and use the description attribute on your operations, and that'll show up in the documentation page. So you can make it easier for people to kind of look at your service and figure out what your different operations do. We've also got this auto content type negotiation, right, where if I'm a client and I'm calling you and I want XML, right, then I'm probably going to pass in an accept header in HTTP that says I want XML. If I'm in a browser and I'm calling this service, I might want to get back JSON. Right? So I can make a call and use JSON, and essentially you can switch this on where it says, look, I'll look at the accept headers, and based on those, I'm going to decide what format to send the response back in. Or I'll look at the request, right, and see that it's JSON and decide whether or not to send JSON back to the client. Right. And finally, right, we've got the integration with the ASP.NET routing, right, where we can now, just like we can for pages and controllers, we can say, look, if somebody comes into a particular URI, I want to route that over to my service and pass in these parameters. So again, I don't need an SVC file to do those things. Right. So let's go out here. I'm going to go and add a new class. Use my examples from earlier. So I'm going to just I'm going to kind of cheat and break the best practices here on services, right? Because I'm not going to bother with an interface. I'm just going to create a class and mark it up. Normally you would do an interface and split that off from the service, but so I'm going to do a list of movies. What I'm going to do is go add an existing project here. where we've actually got some data. And then add a reference. And I'm not going to make this too fancy. I'm just going to have some services so we can see what this thing looks like. So if I've got a list of movies coming back, this is an operation contract. Yeah, and I'm also going to do a web get. URI template equals blank. Okay. So I need to go out and add a reference to my system service model web. That's where my REST pieces are. So I'll go out and grab System Service Model Web and add in that namespace. And so now I've indicated that this is a get operation. We'll just do a quick link query here. And we'll do movies equal, from M in context.movies. Select M, and we'll just take the top. Now we'll do 50. And we'll do movies to list. It's going to complain to me because I don't have some sort of reference in here that I need, like the data entity. So I'll go add that reference. There we go. So now I've got an operation that can return that. If I come out and I'll just copy this, I'll say I want to do a web invoke, and that's going to be to reviews, and the method is going to be post. So if you do a post to that URI, then I'm going to take in a review. Yeah, and we'll pass that in. So at this point, I'm not going to, So I have this now set up. I've got the endpoint out here, right? My service. What I want to do is I need to go out and configure it. So I could go out and put all sorts of stuff in the config, or I could come into my global ASAX. On the application start, I can say something like register routes. And now I can go out and register that service route, right, just like I would for some of the other frameworks in ASP.NET. So I'm going to add one more reference, system.serviceModelActivation. I'm going to add a new service route. Right. And so here we get into what's the prefix. It's movies, right? That's going to be the URL prefix. And then I want a new web service host factory. Right? And the service type is going to be my type of movie service. See if I got enough parentheses on there. So essentially it says, look, if somebody comes in and they go to whack movies, then go out, take a look at that movie service, and try and invoke that, try and find the URI template and map that on here and invoke that particular item. So if we come back out and do an F5 just to get it out there. Ah, I knew I was going to forget that. So you also have to support ASP.NET compatibility mode. which I did on my other service because I knew it would break. Forgot to do it on this one. Ah, you caught me earlier too. Connections. I always forget to copy my connection string over from the data layer. Thank you for being here. So we'll go to the connection strings, make sure those are in the system here. Okay, I don't have any yet. And you can see from the title it's where the wild things are, but it's not showing up because IE likes to change things around when you request the same page with different content types. There we go. There we go. So now I get my objects back. I have an array of movies. Those things are coming back in to that service endpoint. Now, what I want to do, I've got my service up and running, but now I want to enable some of those new features. I want to enable the documentation page and get access to the help for that. So I'm going to go to my web config. Come in. I've got my... Oh, I'm in the wrong project. That's not going to help. Come into my web config. So I've got my service model, and I've got my behaviors. And I've got service behaviors. I'm going to come in and do endpoint behaviors. And if I, again, if I put an unnamed behavior in here, then it's going to apply to all those different endpoints. So this web HTTP used to just be a really empty behavior. You had to apply it to an endpoint to do the rest stuff, but you couldn't really configure things. Right? Now I can come in and say help enabled equals true. Doing it again. It's chugging. Let me do this without debugging and see if that works better. All right, so it's flipping me over there. So I've got the documentation enabled. Where did that go? So, I've got the help enabled equals true. What I need is to go to the root URL for that, and I think because I used the ASP.NET, I messed that up. I did. Let me add in my my service back here. So I've got my moved out of the. I do this explicitly, so I make sure I connect them together. Got my movie service. Oops. I got my endpoint with the binding, the web HTTP binding. Contract is going to be the same thing as up here because I don't have an interface. So we'll grab that. Now we've got our binding down there. Let me go ahead and just make sure I eliminate all issues there, and then we'll try that. It really gets hung up on that first. So, my issue is that I'm mucking around too much with different things. Let me take that off and put the SVC back in just so we can get the right endpoint here. Let me get a text file. We'll do the service equals what's new WCF movie service. Factory equals system dot service model dot activation. Actually, we'll just leave that out and apply it. Tells me that's not quite right. There's no IntelliSense. Okay, there we go. So now we're getting somewhere. So now if we go back to our web config, we've got our endpoint, binding configuration. Oh. It's behavior configuration is web. All right. I think we're sorted now. So now I've got this SVC file that's going to point to my service. That's going to apply that endpoint. We'll see if I get my help page now. There we go. So we've got the web HTTP. That's not the help page I'm supposed to get, though. All right, so that's given us that. All right. Give this one more shot, and then I'm going to move on. That's not what I wanted either. Let's do that. All right. You know, I get to the end of the day, and this is what happens. All right, so we've got movie service out there. What's that? Yeah? Ah. Wouldn't it be nice if it was... Hey, look at that. All right. So we've got that. Now we can fix this because we can say movies. Build. We'll go out here. And we'll go to the service help page. Finally. Thank you for that. All right. So now, was it worth all of that? I don't know. But there's the... There's the help page. So you can see that it tells us, look, if you go to /movies, let me zoom in on that a little bit. If you go to /movies, right, you can only do a get. That's the only operation. And you can see here's the address there, and it just gives you this ugly description. And then if you go to slash reviews, you can do a post. Right? Well, if I go look at the post, now it's going to show me, okay, well, you can do a request. And if you do it in the format of XML, I'll show you an example and give you a schema. If you want to do a request as JSON, I'll give you an example of what that should look like as well. Right? And for the response, in this case, it returned void, so it gives me back an empty. Right? So if I click on schema, it's going to drop me down and show me the XML schema for that. If I click on the example, it's going to give me the XML example for that. If I do the JSON, right, somewhat simpler, although I've got all the entity stuff in there. All right, so after all that, the simple way, right, is essentially on that web HTTP behavior, you now have the control. So I got that all disconnected. But you now have the control on that behavior to turn on the help page, to manage things like the format selection, right, the body style, some of those defaults for how that data gets passed through. All right. And if we go into the reviews, you know, we can throw typed exceptions and do things like that as well. I'm going to kind of move to the next piece in the interest of making sure we get through all of these things. So the other big one is, depends on who you ask. The other feature is WS Discovery, right? And the idea here is this is a specification that's out there. It's an open specification. And it's all about how do I go out and find services in the environment. Right? Typically, when we write services and clients, a lot of times we configure the service with particular endpoints. We go write clients, and we configure those and say, hey, the service is over here. Well, the problem with that in some cases is, what if the service needs to move? Right? What if you've got a use case where you might have an application where you go around to different sites? Right, so you go around to the different sites, and their service exists there for you, but you need to be able to go out and find that service in that particular location. Now, discovery can allow you to go find a service by a number of different ways. You can go out and say, hey, I've got a particular contract that I'm looking for. I want to go find the service that implements that contract. But you can also, at the service side, supply metadata about your service. Because here's some critical information about the service. And then when you go out to query to find services, you can include that in your search criteria. So we're really kind of taking this a step apart now from our client and service and saying, look, we're going to disconnect these things a little bit. They still obviously have a contract that they agree on what operations are available, what messages they're going to exchange. But now the client isn't stuck pointing to a particular endpoint. Right? It has the flexibility to go and find the service. And again, in different environments, maybe find the service that matches certain criteria. Right? It also means that I have the ability to do some versioning capabilities so that when I go out and find these things, right, I can go out and change the service such that if you're going out looking for the latest service, right, when you do that query, you may get version 2 instead of version 1. Right? If you're looking for a particular version, then you might get that exact version. So part of the metadata in my service might be the version number, and I might also have a piece of metadata in there that says whether or not it's the latest. Right, so you could go out and search and say, hey, I want to find the latest version of this particular thing and call that, or I want to go find version 1 or version 2. So I've got a very basic service out here, and if we look, I've got a couple different things I need to do on the service to enable this discovery. One is, on the service itself, it needs an endpoint, right? A UDP discovery endpoint. So you can see I'm using one of those system-based endpoints here, one of the built-in ones. I just say the kind is UDP discovery endpoint. Right? It's UDP. It's going to be doing broadcasts. I don't need to give it a particular address. I'm not going to go in and configure the contract because it's already the same and the binding. Everything about that is wrapped up in the fact that I just picked that particular kind, so I don't have to do any more configuration on it. So I put that on there, and then I also apply a behavior to my service, and I say, well, service discovery behavior, and I put an announcement endpoint on there. Basically says, look, here's a behavior. When my service starts up, the behavior will kick in, And this announcement behavior then will go out and start announcing the presence of my service. Right? Basically broadcasting out on the network, hey, there's a service available that meets these criteria. So I've got my discovery endpoint on this service. I've got the behavior applied. And I also need to host a different service. In this case, it's this announcement listener, right? That's responsible for listening for those announcements coming back in or listening for things from the network. So it's kind of these three different pieces in here that I've got in order to make the service discoverable. Now, the service hosting code, I didn't do anything different. It's all in the config. Right? I create an instance of my service host, and I open it. So all of this is being driven by the configuration and enabling that discovery. On the client side, I'm going to go in and use this discovery client. Just create a new instance of this class, and I pass into it through code the UDP discovery endpoint. I basically say, hey, look, here's a client endpoint. It's the UDP discovery. You know what your contract is. You're going to go out and use UDP to try and find me this. And then I call client.find. And here, again, I'm just using the contract and saying, go find me a service that implements this contract. And I might get back one response or no responses. I might get back many. All right, so in this find response, what I get back is a set of endpoints, all right, for all the services it found that matched that particular criteria. And so if I didn't find any here, I'm writing that out. Otherwise, I'm going to go out and just say, all right, well, I want to create a proxy now. And I know what the binding is in this case, and I want to just go get from the endpoints the address for that. Right, so now I know dynamically, I went out, I used this discovery, I figured out where that endpoint is. I can use the address now to go out and call it. Right, so the rest of this is all just calling that service. So if we run that, okay, the service is up and running. Now run this. Now, one of the things you'll notice is it does take some time at first because there's, first of all, I'm plugged into the network and I've got all sorts of stuff going on, but it's going out and the service is out there broadcasting. The client's going to go out and look for this. Right? So at the beginning, it takes a little bit of time for it to find the service initially using this model and get back the response. I've also got some timeouts and things that I could configure. Right? If I'm going out and doing a search, it's trying to find all the matches. So I've got it just set up with the defaults, and it finds the service, and then it goes out and just calls that web service. Right. So it's a SOAP-based web service. The WS Discovery works with these SOAP-based web services. Gives me that abstraction now, or that disconnect between the client and service, so I don't really need to know the address. Now, this model I used was just kind of a multicast where the service was just broadcasting out, and the client was broadcasting out and looking. There's also a more centralized model where you can have a service discovery node where your service can come online and register and say, hey, I'm a service, here's my criteria and here's my addresses. And the client, when it comes online, then instead of kind of broadcasting out and trying to find these things, it just goes to that central node and tries to find it there. So you get a little more control, a little more centralized, not as much broadcasting going on, and a little bit easier to find that information. So you can use either mode with that. All right. Questions on the discovery? All right. The other big thing is the workflow services. So they've taken a lot of effort in Workflow 4 and WCF 4 to make sure these things are really well integrated. They've got the ability for you to, when you define your service logic, instead of writing .NET code, you're going to write workflows and use activities to define the processing steps. What that means is they had to provide messaging activities for you to receive WCF messages and send replies, and also to go out and consume WCF services from your workflows. Right? So it allows me to deal with those cases where my particular service might not just be a call to get some data or might not just be a call to do something. My service may be part of a bigger process, or I'm going to make multiple calls to complete that process, and I want to have in the workflow a way to see that overall process, to manage that overall process. Or it might be that I've got short-lived operations, but I want to use a workflow to implement that so I can take advantage of that declarative programming model and simplify the operations that I'm doing inside that service to go out and query multiple services maybe. So these declarative services, when you build them, you can, you're building them with XAML. Right? You're going to build them just like a workflow. And you can either host them yourself using the workflow service host class, or you can use IIS. Right. Now, IIS, using Windows Activation Service under the covers, if you're on IIS 7. And App Fabric is this new set of tooling that's coming that makes it easier to manage services when they're hosted in IIS. And here you can use this file extension of XAMLX. So you install the .NET framework, all these file extensions, the XAMLX and the SVC, they all get mapped onto the appropriate handlers. So I can just take that workflow service and a web config and drop it in my virtual directory, and now that's my endpoint for my service. And somebody can come along and call that. One of the common things that comes up is, as you're doing these workflow services, if your goal is to have a long-running service, then you're probably going to have multiple messages coming in. And in the past, the only way that you could correlate those messages together without writing a lot of custom code was by passing along an HTTP cookie or a SOAP header with this GUID in it that was your workflow ID. Right? So it was this context-based exchange that had to go on. And so one of the great new features is they've added message correlation where I can say, you know what, I've already got some identifier. Right? You send me a message, I send you a response. There's some piece of data in there, a customer ID, an order ID, right, or a combination of things that's going to be unique for this interaction. And so when you send me back another message, I just want to be able to correlate those things together or relate them together based on that data in the message. I don't want to have to pass a unique identifier along and a SOAP header or a cookie. I'm already passing data in the message, and I want to correlate that together. Right. So you can think of, you know, if I've got an application here and I'm going to start some job, so the first call comes in and says, all right, well, the job has a particular ID. And what I'm going to do is store that out, that ID, that mapping, and say, well, for that particular job, I want to keep track of that. Right. I'm going to send some message off to some system, and later I'm going to get back this receipt or this response message. Well, I need to make sure that goes back to the right instance of my service or my workflow. Right. You think about, hey, if I've got a workflow managing somebody's order and I call out to the shipping department and tell them to ship something, when they send me an acknowledgement back, I better make sure it comes to the right workflow so that I can tell the right person your order is shipped. Right? We've got an instance of this process that's running for a particular job or particular order. Right? So we need to be able to go out and look up and say, well, we've got a message and it's got a job ID in it of 123. Which workflow instance or which service instance does that map to? Right. So in your orchestration, can you tell I've done BizTalk too much? In your workflow, the way you do this is you use a correlation handle. It's just a class that's going to manage these values for you, and you're going to then configure some messaging activities to do this. So rather than talk about it with slides, let me go in here. So I've just got a workflow service. So you can see it's a .xamlx file. It starts with a sequence. And this is a receive activity. A messaging activity that allows me to receive a particular method or implement a particular operation. If we look over here, I can get the sizer. Come on. There we go. You can see that when you build these services, you build the contract as part of the workflow. So as I go and build this out, I'm saying, hey, I'm going to receive a message. Here's the operation name. Here's the service contract name. And this is defining my WCF service contract. Now, normally in WCF, you go write an interface, right, and then you implement that interface. Here, you're doing kind of workflow-first service development, where as you build the workflow, you're defining that contract as you go. All right, so I have an operation called submit report, and then the content allows me to specify, well, what is it that I'm receiving? Right, and here I've specified a variable of report, which we can see down here, right, is an expense report. So my service operation is going to look like submit report, passes in an expense report, and then I have a response down here in this send reply to receive. Right, and that also has content, and that's this report confirmation. So by using these activities, you know, receive a message, send a reply, I'm shaping what my WCF service looks like. And so when you send in an expense report, I receive it and send you back a confirmation. Then down here, I'm going to wait for the manager response. Right, so here we've got a new operation, submit manager response, with the same namespace. And the content now is just a different variable, which is the manager response. Right. And all these types are simply .NET types that I've got up here that use all the standard WCF data contract stuff. Right. So the key with these is, you know, I'm implementing this, but I also need to do that correlation. So on this first one, when I send back the reply, I'm sending back a, let me pop this up in the editor so you can see it. I'm sending back a confirmation, and I'm sending back a report ID. Right. So I'm going to set the report ID to some random number. And for the response coming back then, for the manager's response, he or she's going to need to include that. Right. And it's going to be part of that manager response message. Right. That particular class already contains a property that I can use to identify the particular report. Right. So if I send back to the client, say, here's the report confirmation, the report ID is 57, then when the manager comes back and submits me one of these manager responses with an item ID of 57, I want to be able to map those things together. Right. So I go onto the service, right, and on this send reply, I have this correlation initializers where I essentially say, look, I'm going to initialize some variable, this report ID handle, this correlation handle. I'm going to initialize it. I'm going to put some values in it that say, here's the values I'm looking for. And in this case, I go out and I'm using this XPath, right? And I'm going out and simply pointing at the type. This will look easier if I go here. You can see here's the return type that I'm passing back, and it allows me to just select the value out of there, and it knows then the XPath to go in and grab that. So that as this message is going back out over the wire, it can pluck that value out and store it away and say, ah, for that particular ID, we know what the workflow instance is. And the other half of that then is when I receive, on that next one, I've got to have a match. So same key name. Right? The value can come from somewhere completely different. Right here it's coming from that item identifier. So I have the ability to go out and grab the value from anywhere in that incoming message and say, look, if that matches what I stored away, then this is a match. So let me just go out and run this. So I'll run the employee app, and what this is going to do is simply call the service initially. Right. It says, all right, I called the web service. I got back an ID of 22, right, and my status of submitted. So I've shut that down now. The client app is gone. I'm going to come from a different application and start this manager app and hope that you guys remember what that number was. Not very exciting, right? What happened? Well, it went out, it found that instance, and it submitted the manager's approval. If I go back and start this again and put in some random ID, and I just say 57, now I'm going to get an exception. Right? Oh, it won't go into break mode, right? Where it basically says, hey, you know what? The execute... Smart tag got in the way. The execution of this instance persistence command was interrupted. Right, it's basically saying, look, I tried to go load the workflow based on that report ID you gave me, but I can't because there's no match. Right? I don't have anything that was expecting that report ID. And so I can't find it, can't load it in that particular scenario. So the message correlation allows you to use that message data, right? Receive messages that are related to each other by some piece of data or set of data. I could use more than one value to do my correlation. So what that looks like then is, you know, when I start, I take that job ID, right? I'm using that correlation query now to pull out this value and store it in that handle and also in the database, right? And then when I receive that next message, it's going to do a match. It's going to say, well, here's the query. I'm going to go look up that job ID from here, and I'm going to try and match it to what's in my store so I can find the right instance. Right. So the content-based, to me, is the most exciting, but there is still the protocol-based correlation where you are passing that SOAP header or the cookie around. You still have that available, so if you're using that today and like it, you can keep doing that. All right. And the last kind of big new feature is the routing service. And the routing service is about taking the notion in services and kind of these boundaries being abstractions and providing you with an intermediary. Right, if you think about between the client and service, a lot of times we really don't know if there's anything going on in between them. Right, I know that I send a message out from the client, it gets to the service, I get a response back. But having something in the middle, like a router, enables me to do all sorts of different things. As long as it doesn't mess with my messages, things can be quite nice. Right? So from the client's perspective, it thinks it's calling a service. Right? It doesn't realize that it's actually sending its messages to the router. And what the router can do then is look at the message and make decisions about, well, what actual physical service and implementation am I going to pass this to? And so it kind of exposes these loose endpoints, or these wide open endpoints, where it can receive any message coming in. And so on your particular service, you would, you know, for metadata, you would say, well, look, I'm going to listen on a particular address, but I'm going to tell any clients that they should call on a different address. And you can do that through a combination of the listen URI attribute and the address. Okay. And so what the router can do then is use this generic contract. It just gets messages. Now, it can support a variety of different message exchange patterns. You have to put out the right contract, right? So when I go out, I'm going to have to host this router service. I'm going to say, look, you are exposing an endpoint, and it's a request reply router, right? Which means my service, right, needs to support request reply style semantics, right? It may or may not have a session. If I use the datagram, right, it's more of a one-way mechanism where I'm expecting one-way messages. So I've got to have the right contract there to manage that. But what the routing service does then is it allows you to define these filters. Right? So you've got messages from the client coming to the routing service, and you're going to configure it and say, well, here's a bunch of filters. Right? And for a given filter, if it matches, here's the endpoint, the client endpoint that you should call. So the router gets messages, looks at the filters, and then decides, well, which actual service am I going to route this to? Right? So you apply a behavior to the routing service, and then you'll configure that with the filters. Now, there's a number of different filters that you can use. You can look at a variety of different headers, like the action, the addresses, or the endpoint name. You can do a match all, which basically says everything that comes in should match this. You can do an XPath. Right? So you can look at a particular value within the message if you want to and make decisions based on that. Right? You also have the ability to plug in custom. Right? So you can do your own custom matching on the message, initialize your custom class, and be able to go look at the message and make decisions about whether or not it's a match. So you can do a couple different things with this. I'll show you one example, but you might do, you know, service virtualization. Hey, a request comes into the router. I'm going to decide you know, whether or not that goes to one service, or maybe I've got, you know, two different services and different messages are going to get routed to each one, right? So to you, it looks like one service. Maybe it's a travel service, but requests for flights go off to one partner service and requests for hotels go somewhere else. The data partitioning or process, right? You've got different clients that are calling this, and based on the client that's calling, maybe they've got a higher priority, so they're going to go to endpoint that's running on beefier machines, or you've got data privacy issues. So every client that comes in, they all hit the same endpoint of the router. You're going to split them off to different instances of the service that use different data. Right? You can also use this for service versioning. You might look at that message coming in and decide, oh, this is still a message that should go to version one of the service. Or if somebody's calling it and they're using the new message, right, your new version of the message, then you could route it over to the new version. Right? The clients don't have to change their address and change a lot of things on their end as you make those changes. And then one of the other big things this allows is protocol translation. Right? They worked really hard to get this working where it might be as simple as, hey, the client's calling with SOAP 1.1, and your service is using SOAP 1.2. Right? Different versions of the spec, and it'll map those things over. But it might also be that the client's calling on HTTP, and from the router back to your service is going to use TCP. Right? And they've done a lot to bridge that whole protocol across those. And then you can also do multicast for the one-way scenarios. I get a message in. The router then can multicast that out to several different one-way endpoints. Right. So just a couple of examples, the service virtualization, right, where I've got to the client what looks like one service, but in reality is more than one service in the back end, and the router decides for different messages where they should go. Right. Or for the service partitioning, right, again, I look at the message and decide, oh, is this for the Microsoft, and they want to get some travel, or is this for somebody from Pluralsight? And I'm going to use different data and possibly different logic out there to do that. Right. Service versioning, right? Same kind of thing there. So let me go out and just show you an example of this. I know we're getting towards the end of the day here. So what I have got is I've got a service out here. And if we look, what I'm hosting is not my own service, but the system service model routing.routing service. This is the router. You host it. And it's not a Windows service or anything that you start up. It's a WCF service, and you host it. So you decide where that's going to live. And I'm simply going to host that with the default factory here. And so in my web config, I'm going to come out, and I've got a couple things. I've got client endpoints that point to my two different physical services. So in this case, I'm going to do that data partitioning. I've got one implementation of the service that uses certain data for Microsoft and another one that's got access to different data for Pluralsight. We're going to get, when we go and search for travel, we're going to get different results because we're working with different sets of data. And so these are the client endpoints. This is what the router is going to call one of these. I host the routing service, and I need to apply, right, a particular contract on the endpoint. So I'm using the iRequestReply router. That's one of those contracts that it implements. Right, which is essentially, hey, I'm going to do request response style. I don't want to use session here. I want to just apply that. Right. And then for the behavior that I apply, I simply put in this routing, and I say, yeah, I want to apply this behavior, and here's the filter table name. Right. Now, unfortunately, all this configuration that you're going to do right here in the config file. It's all XML. Right. But I'm going to define then some filters. Right. So I'll say I'm going to do an XPath filter. Right. I'm going to go down and look at the SOAP envelope and look for a header called client. And if that equals PS, right, then I'm going to say that this is a match. Right? And if it equals MS, then I'm going to say this is a match. And so down in the filter table, right, what I'm saying is, well, look, if this filter is a match, if the PS filter is a match, then the client endpoint you should use is the PS travel client. Right. So if you found that SOAP header and the value was PS, then here's the client endpoint that points to the service that you should call. If you found that value and it was MS, then here's a different client endpoint. So messages coming into the router, it's going to look at that SOAP header and say, oh, look, if it's got a particular value, it goes here. If it's got a different value, it's going to go over here. So I've got these hosted out in IIS. If we take a look, I've got the core where I've got under my flights, that's where I've got my routing service. And then the MS Travel is where I've got the Microsoft version, and the PS Travel is the plural site. So those are the same. The difference is, and if we go and look, let's see if it'll browse. Is that we've got different values. So if you look, I'm using an XML file for my flight data just to keep it simple. So the plural site costs are always a lot higher. I'm not sure how Microsoft Travel does it, but when they book flights for me, it's always about a third of what I would pay. So if I go out now and run my client, right, what I'm going to do in the client is I'm going to specify a header right in the config file. So I'll put PS in. So under the endpoint, I can just do headers, right, call it client and put PS. So if I run that and we do a search, you'll see what I get for data. Right, I get Northwest, which is no more. It's now Delta. And I get these high prices of over $1,000 for that trip. If I simply go into the config file and change that now, and I do the same search, I'm going against a different instance of the service. I'm getting different data on the back end from that XML file, so I get different results back here on the client. As far as the client's concerned, it called one service. The only thing different was that, in my case, the SOAP header. It could have been any number of factors that the router used, but that's all that was different with the messages. Different implementations, different sets of data, so I get entirely different results back on the client. In fact, I even got different airlines for that. All right. So the routing service is all about kind of enabling those scenarios of having an intermediary, having a lot more control over those messages, and having some flexibility in how they get handled. It also has some capabilities around error handling and providing you kind of a fallback list. So if you try and call that particular service and it fails, you can identify kind of a chain of other endpoints that it can use to fall back on and try and call those as well. So it gives you some fault tolerance that way in terms of a service being down or one particular endpoint being down. You might have alternative service implementations on different addresses, for example. Can you add a service at runtime? Probably with a custom, I was going to say with a custom match, but I don't know that you could add a service at runtime because the client endpoints are configured in the config file. Right. Right, you'd need to restart the router service to pick up the configuration. I'm trying to think if there's a way you could programmatically get in and add some of those in. I mean, certainly the way the behavior is working is it's going to look at the filter table and go find those named endpoints. You might have the ability to go in, though, through code. I'm just not thinking of the exact classes you'd use and add some other client endpoints into that run space for your client application or for your router service, so that it would have the notion of more client endpoints that you could add in dynamically. All right, well, thank you, everybody, for sticking in there. I know we're at 5:30. I'll stick around if anybody has questions, either about the WCF stuff or any of the other stuff from earlier today. Unfortunately, I won't be around for the rest of the conference because I have to go up to The Hague tonight and do dev days tomorrow. So if you want to catch me, now's the time to do it. Otherwise, I'll say thank you for coming today and enjoy the rest of the conference. Thanks.